So let's begin with an image taken from a book that you may perhaps have read, Into the Wild, which was made into a movie maybe about 10, 15 years ago, based on an essay written by John Krakauer, which was published in like 1993, detailing events that had just taken place recently. So a word about the protagonist of that story and how it can be like brought to bear on the topic that we entertain together. So Into the Wild tells the story of Christopher McCandless. He was one of eight children, one, you know, full sister, as it were, or blood sister, and then six half-brothers and sisters. He grew up in Annandale, Virginia. His father worked for the Jet Propulsion Lab, and he had a kind of normal suburban upbringing, himself very intelligent and very capable. He went to Emory University and was an honors graduate of the school in about 1990, I believe. And at that point, he determined that he was going to do something radical with his life. So upon graduating, he had told his parents that he would go back up to Annandale, spend some time with them, check in, but instead, he just dropped off the grid. Now, mind you, as you come to appreciate in reading the original essay, I think which is called Death of an Innocent, or Into the Wild itself, he's a very intelligent man, perhaps sometimes ideological or even demagogical, but very intelligent. He was very compassionate as well and concerned for the poor. He found it maddening. He found it distracting to even think that one could perish from starvation, especially in the United States, so close to many who had such material wealth. So he wanted to throw in his lot with the outcast, to somehow throw in his lot with the poor. And so in a way that's somehow reminiscent of the exploits of a George Orwell, he decided to live intensely as a kind of tramp. And so he began in 1990, tramping throughout the United States, sometimes living in cities, sometimes working his way through national parks or recreation areas, but always being radically unprepared and kind of abandoned to what we might call providence, but to what he called chance or fortune. So he spent over 2 years doing this, and during that time he had no communication with his family. And that for them was a source of great sadness. It's not so much that he spurned them, as that he didn't think so much of them. He kind of neglected them. He was motivated in part by a desire to find lonely places where he might dwell in peace, undisturbed by the turmoil and the temptations of the world. The last trip that he took, his last tramping exploit, was in Denali National Park. He wended his way there from, I believe, one of the Dakotas. It took him about 10 to 12 days taking trains, hitchhiking. Once he got up into the Northwest Territories, it was exceedingly difficult to find rides. But he eventually made his way there to Denali National Park. And the man who brought him up to the access road watched as he left his map, his watch, and his money in the front seat of the car. He didn't even bring a compass, so there was no compass to leave. And when the driver of the vehicle protested and said, "You know, you'll need these things," he responded, Christopher responded, "I don't want to know what time it is," he declared cheerfully. "I don't want to know what day it is or where I am. None of that matters." As he made his way into Denali National Park, he crossed a river. This was in April that he endeavored to do so. And at the time, it was frozen over, so a lot of snowpack in the area at the time. And he eventually found a bus where he camped out, a bus that had kind of broken down and been abandoned, and that had been used by hikers, I guess, throughout the course of years as a kind of haunt. And so he established his camp in this place. And when he did, he wrote a manifesto, and he published it on the outside of the vehicle. It wrote, 2 years he walks the earth. No phone, no pool, no pets, no cigarettes. Ultimate freedom. An extremist. An aesthetic voyager whose home is the road. Escaped from Atlanta. Thou shalt not return, because the West is the best. And now, after two rambling years, comes the final and greatest adventure, the climactic battle to kill the false being within and victoriously conclude the spiritual pilgrimage. 10 days and nights of freight trains and hitchhiking bring him to the great white north. No longer to be poisoned by civilization, he flees and walks alone upon the land to become lost in the world. So you get there a taste for his flair, his drama. It's exciting. It carries you away. So he spent over 3 months in the bush, subsisting on what he could hunt and what he could gather. And though he tried his hand at hunting and experienced some success, he was always in a bit of a caloric debt. So he would, you know, catch small game, squirrels, grouse, He once shot a caribou but was unable to maintain the meat well enough to actually use it for an extended period of time. But he was always below the level of flourishing, or he was always below the level of subsistence. After a couple of months, he was actually satisfied with his exploit, and he was content to return to civilization. But when he went back to the river, it was no longer ice-covered. Instead, it was, you know, swollen by all of the water from the snowmelt, and he wasn't able to cross. It later came to light that he could actually have crossed about a quarter mile south because there was a small pulley that you could use to convey yourself across, but he didn't have a map, so he didn't know that. So he returned to his bus, and on the brink of starvation, he was kind of desperate, and he began, he was more, I suppose, adventurous in the things that he would eat. And while he was accustomed to eat this one particular kind of plant, he ended up eating another particular kind of plant, which looked a lot like it, but which was in fact poisonous. And so already in deep debt, he was paralyzed, he was unable really to marshal any strength, and he eventually suffered paralysis, and he died in the bus, only to be discovered 2.5 weeks later. It's interesting, when you read the report of those who found him, he had had at one point like a 10-pound bag of rice and some supplies, but he was wildly underprepared, and he did so deliberately. On a couple of occasions, he had ventured into the Mojave Desert, and there he had lost some 35 pounds, and he became kind of energized by or proud of these exploits. But one thing that he did not skimp on was books. So in his 25, 30-pound pack, he brought 10 books with him, among which were a novel by Tolstoy, Gogol, Thoreau, Pasternak, Jack London. One of the last entries in his journal, which he kept pretty closely before the abortive attempt to return home, was a two-word entry taken from the title of the Tolstoy work that he had brought with him, which simply read, Family Happiness. In one of the books discovered by his corpse, Dr. Zhivago, was found highlighted the line, Happiness is only real when shared. Happiness is only real when shared. So we take this image, or we take this story, because it sets before us a kind of problem. Modern man and woman share something of the radical isolation that Christopher McCandless sought purposefully to cultivate. And yet, modern man and woman are haunted by a similar fear that real life can only be discovered at a great cost. And the question is whether we are willing to endeavor that feat, or whether we will be consumed by our experience of isolation. So, perhaps on, you know, a somewhat lighter note, consult your own experience. Think about college. College is a time of concentrated togetherness. You are always with other people. And sometimes when you want to, like, fall asleep at a time other than when your roommate wants to fall asleep, you know, you can experience this acutely. So you are in the dorm with other people. You are in, you know, the cafeteria or dining halls with other people. You are in the classroom with other people. You spend most or much of your time with other people. But in what sense do we spend time with other people? As an analytic philosopher might ask, what work is the word with doing in that sentence? What does it mean to be with other people? I think a lot of people find that it's difficult. This is irrespective of time, place, age, vocation, whatever. They find it difficult to forge meaningful connections. And I think that we can isolate in this kind of present evil age, as it were, two reasons for which. You could multiply examples, but I've chosen to isolate two. Think first of competition, and then think of irony. So first, competition. You are pitted, whether we are recollected in the fact, but we are constantly pitted in competition. And it has a way of kind of cultivating in us a materialist or reductionist mode of thought. Now, I suspect that many of you here present are probably theists. So you're saying, like, materialism? Reductionism? Are you kidding? I'm not a materialist. I'm not a reductionist. Take it back. Okay, so I'm not speaking about it in that sense. I'm talking about materialist, like being materialist in another sense. And I think we can simply express it in this way, that we tend to think of all goods as scarce goods. We tend to think of all goods as scarce goods. So think about how we treat time, for instance. I suspect that at a place like this, there is a high standard of hyper-efficiency, which you are expected to recognize, realize, perform according to. So whether you are exercising or driving or walking to class, it is not sufficient simply to do the one thing. That would be a profligate waste of your time. No, you have to use the opportunity to check in with the people back at home whom you would otherwise neglect if it were, you know, left to you to sit in one place and call them. You have to listen to the podcasts, the kind of like lingua franca of contemporary conversation, right? You have to finish up your homework in as much as one can do so with a kind of jostle of steps on the way to class. But what you simply cannot do is just the one thing. You simply cannot do just the one thing. Perhaps you've even maybe recorded lectures and played them while you sleep, for God forbid that you just do the one thing of sleeping. So we think of all goods as scarce goods. First, we talked about time. Second, excellence. We find ourselves often unconsciously competing with our classmates, with our contemporaries, whether it be for internships or for fellowships or for graduate school admission, or simply for the honor which is accorded to those who excel and simply cannot be spread over the entire student body. You made it. You got in. Kudos. Would that that were enough. No, there is a constant competition for excellence, and we perceive it often as scarce. And in some way, we can find ourselves moved in fine shades by envy, where we see the good of another as a hindrance to our own. For another, to receive honor, fame, glory, represents a kind of deficit in our own attainment to those goods. Think then of love. Love. It is not sufficient for us often to be loved by our friends and acquaintances. We want to be loved more. We want to be loved most. We want to be loved by comparison. We want to be preferred, consulted, and esteemed. It's not sufficient that you hear, "That was a great class presentation." You so desperately want to hear, "I so desperately want to hear, that was the best class presentation." And something short of that, smarts. Because to be among the madding crowd, the common horde, this is detestable. So, think of these goods, or we think of these goods, I suppose, as if they were material things. We think of them as if they were pieces of a pizza, and when one person takes a slice, that is one fewer for me to enjoy. Even if I can't eat all eight, and I am cognizant of the fact that I am not capable of such feats, it still hurts me to see those pieces depleted. So that's the first. We are pitted in constant competition, and it makes us materialistic and reductionistic in our thinking. Recall, the theme is that happiness cannot be had alone, and we talked about Christopher McCandless as one who tried to endeavor happiness as a solitary project and came up against the recognition that it could not be accomplished. And now we're acknowledging here certain obstacles to doing things together, the first of which is competition, the second of which is ironic speech, or the culture of irony. I think that we're kind of in a movement back to a sincerity of a sort. I think that authenticity or genuineness or sincerity are more so esteemed now than they may have been like 5 years ago. For those of you who may have watched the show Seinfeld, there's like no real point to it except that the characters ironize each other. But in the shows that, you know, people nowadays find more so funny, like The Office, for instance, there are kind of like charming reconciliations. So David Foster Wallace identified this and pointed to the recovery of a new sincerity, that even when we ironize, we're hoping that we can reconstitute something like a meaningful relationship. But still, irony deeply infects our kind of manner of life and our mode of speech. What do I mean by this? It's often difficult to know what your friends think, what they actually think. It is difficult to know what your friends actually think. Consult your own experience. Oftentimes, perhaps you're in a situation where you feel some pain, trial, or difficulty, or you're overwhelmed, overburdened by life, but you don't want to express that to another human being because to do so would be to appear weak or pitiable. You don't want to consult with a friend lest they think you a burden, or you feel somehow condescended to, as if you were their patient and they your therapist. Perhaps you've had a kind of revulsion when you hear one of your friends talking about helping a third party, a mutual friend, and then you have the thought, "I would never want my name in her mouth in the manner in which it is currently being used. Like, I don't want to be pitied as such. I don't want to burden as such." So what we do, what many do, I should say, is we share little, And we traffic in ready-made and witty responses. And this generates a kind of culture of irony. It can sometimes be cynical and embittered, but in its most benign forms, it's just kind of flippant. So if someone were to ask you, how are you doing? Now, mind you, in the American setting, we feel, I think, at pains to over-manifest, right? You, like, have to tell people how you're doing. That's not normal in other, you know, cultures. Like, in Europe, for instance, for me to be, like, you know, like, wildly taxed, like, at my wit's end, I need your help right now. If you were to say that to a Swiss person, they'd be like, all the best, right? So there already is a kind of strange culture of artificial vulnerability in the United States, but still we find ways of deflecting and distancing. So how are you doing? Hard to say. Or living the dream. What does that mean? What does that mean? Whose dream? Is it your dream? I don't know. I mean, what does that actually mean? So it's difficult to discern the fundamental commitments of your classmates and confreres, and when you do, they just as quickly kind of slough them off, right? It's just irony all the way down. And what happens in the end is that you forbid the discovery of a common ground on which to build. And this is recognizably, manifestly isolating and alienating. It is inimical to any real sharing. And yet, I submit that the sharing of a meaningful life is just about the only thing in the world worth doing. So, the ember of this flame still smolders in our culture. It's up to us that it not be snuffed out. So how does one live the good life together? Here is the one kind of significant doctrinal point. I want to talk about the common good and use that as a way to bring into focus how friendship brings before us, or kind of brings before our eyes, this notion and initiates us into a culture of common goods. So classical conceptions of the good life or of happiness typically focus on shared activity. In the Aristotelian language, we're supposed to have highest exercise of highest powers in a communal setting. So you're supposed to fire on all cylinders as a rational animal, but also as a social animal and as a political animal. And you are born into those networks of relationships. You are born as mutually entailed, as the son or daughter of a mother and father, right? As the brother or sister of your siblings, as one who speaks this language, who is from this state, in this country, pertaining to this intermediate institution, as, you know, whatever you get, you see how this is going. But you're always born into a network of relationships. And so in the classical understanding, your flourishing takes into account that for you to be a knower and a lover always has a communal setting and dimension, right? So classical conceptions of the good life and of happiness focus on shared activity. But our understanding of the common good has undergone pretty significant transformations in the last century, specifically because of totalitarianism and collectivism. And so we're made nervous by corporate identity because it somehow does not adequately reflect my unique and individual personality, and it threatens to subsume my individual personality within some Borg that could be deployed for nefarious purposes. So it just makes us nervous to talk about it. So what we want to do here is recover a kind of classic sense of the common good that will keep our personalist interests in the fore, but also help us to make sense of why we need not react so strongly. So the common good, according to Aristotle and Aquinas, kind of broadly conceived. In this understanding, the common good is both truly good and truly common. So truly good and truly common. Let's take those in reverse order. So truly good. What do we mean by good? What does it mean to say that something is good? Perhaps you've heard talk of truth, goodness, and beauty before. You've heard this trifecta kind of trotted out, maybe identified as transcendentals, so-called because in Aristotle's understanding, we try to categorize reality. So there are things, like substances, and then there are things which pertain to the things, which he calls accidents, right? So he kind of divides up reality where there are, you know, there's rocks, there are trees, there are animals, to quote the movie Land Before Time 1, rocks, trees, Spike, all pertaining to the category of things that do not fly. And then you have accidents, which qualify those things, right? So some things are brown, some things are 6 feet 4 inches, some things are strangely dressed. You know, we make these accidental attributions. But what the transcendentals name are philosophical categories that go across all of these categories, something that we can find in all of these categories. So the typical description starts with being. Whether one is a rock or the relation of being the son of a father, there is being at stake. All right? And then from that, St. Thomas in his argumentation, the prima pars of the Summa Theologiae, he builds out his vision. So we say, we attribute being to what is. And then from that, we make the determination that it is in a certain sense undivided. It has a kind of integrity. It kind of, he calls it a transcendental indivision, which is to say that it's this thing as apart from this other thing. And this he just refers to as unity. So what is also one. And he says this unity is addressed to a mind. First and primarily, it issues from a mind. And this you have like St. Augustine's doctrine of the divine ideas in the background, which is not important for our purposes, but truth means that this thing is intelligible. Insofar as it is one, it can be known. It can be known. So it's addressed to an intellect for cognizing. And then he builds out the vision further yet. If addressed to an intellect, specifically to an immaterial intellect, then the will or rational appetite inclines spontaneously towards that thing which is apprehended as good. So goodness describes being, oneness, truth. It's the next piece or the next development which signifies that the thing is addressed to an appetite, that it is alluring, that it is seducing, that it is beguiling, that it represents for us an object of interest. So we can talk about appetite in a variety of registers. So Aristotle will talk about a natural appetite. All substances, he says, desire to preserve their existence. Or we can talk about sensitive appetite, which is like you have a vision of a thing sensibly good. So perhaps it's food or drink or, you know, like the propagation of the species through procreation and education of children. These things appear as good, and then they motivate a sense response. And then at the highest level, there's intellectual appetite or will, whereby something is apprehended as good in an immaterial sense, and it motivates a response. So appetite functions at these three levels. Now, as we kind of fill out our image of the good, we remark first that it contributes to the building up of a being. So it's not just good in the sense of like a value irrespective of me. Like it's good, like good, you be you, and I'll be me, and never the twain shall meet. We recognize it as good precisely because it is addressed to us. Right? Because it leaps out of the otherwise neutral fabric of reality and captures our attention as somehow meriting a response. In what sense? Well, because it's the type of accidental quality that, if assimilated, makes me more perfectly me. Now, this doesn't have to just be in the case of a human being, but you know, we can talk about anything that is inclined to a good sees it as somehow representing for it a perfection. Perfection, from the Latin, per facere, to be made through and through. So we're the type of creature that is on the way and not at the end. And in order to attain to the end, we need to be in fruitful engagement with good things. Which is to say that we will not just spontaneously or automatically become good. We know this by virtue of the fact that we have to study. Melioration is laborious. And it entails a kind of discipline or an exercise in engaging well with the good. So it's an accidental quality which makes the thing to be yet more perfectly what it is. Here, a concrete instance. So you are made somewhat ambivalent to things to be known, right? You come here, you choose a major, you select classes, but then you have some liberty as to how you fill in your schedule. And you're like, I don't know what I'm interested in, truth be told. I could take like discrete mathematics, I could take a course on relativism, I could take a course on, you know, like the classic joke one is underwater basket weaving. But like which ones appeal to me? But as you grow as a knower and a lover, that focus is narrowed according to your vocation, as it were. That's not to say that we become unimaginative and boring, but the good appeals to us in a way that is more concrete, that is more perfectly filled out. So what we have at the outset are kind of like sketches, adumbrations. We're like, I don't know what I'm into. But then as you are formed in knowledge, which is a virtue in the kind of classical understanding, an intellectual virtue, that you are trained in the pursuit of the very thing which represents your flourishing. So say you are going to be a systems engineer. You might set out at the beginning and study like math, some chemistry, some physics. You might say take some engineering courses, but then you recognize the fact like I've got to saddle up. Otherwise, I'm going to have to be taking like 21 credits for my last three semesters. That may happen regardless, but here we go. Right? And so it kind of focuses you and energizes you in pursuit of the good that you recognize as good for you. So another way by which the good is described in the Aristotelian corpus is that which all men desire. I love this definition because it's not so much a definition in the strict sense as it is a kind of phenomenological observation. We call those things good which are desirable. St. Thomas uses a similar definition with respect to what is beautiful. He says, we call those things beautiful which, when seen, please. Notice, it's kind of got a modesty to it. He doesn't say, like, I can define for you beauty in exacting detail so as to, like, dispel all mystery. He says, beauty is a vision that arrests. That is all I know. And mind you, he speaks at greater length, but I think that to start with that is good. So, we call those things good which all men desire, those things which represent for us a perfection. And the last thing to say about what is good is that it serves for us as a kind of final cause. Now, if you've had like a history of science course, you know that final causes were done away with at some point, maybe 400 years ago, as a cult in unverifiable causes, right? How can we test for final causes? We simply can't. So dismiss them from the conversation. They are so much foolishness. Right, what do we mean by final cause? We mean that nature obtains always and for the most part. All right, Father Gregory, that's a wildly uninteresting claim. What do you mean? Okay, I will expound. So, that certain things do certain things. Okay. Pellucid. The fact of what you are is indicative of the things for which you are made. Now, some of you who may know some David Hume are like, whoa, pump the brakes. That sounds like the naturalistic fallacy. Before we get into any consideration of modern philosophy, all we're basically saying is that because this thing is what it is, certain things are good for it and certain things are less good for it. And we recognize this in a kind of fundamental way. Because I am an embodied human being, it's good for me to avoid buses that are barreling down the road at 25 miles per hour, and it's good for me to stop at crosswalks. Right? That's not like a very contentious claim. You know, only the most effete academic philosopher would say, like, well, maybe it is good for you to get in front of a bus. It's like, no, okay, not good, no bueno. So because of what I am, namely embodied, it's good for me to preserve my bodily existence, and therefore it is bad for me to endeavor those things which will almost necessarily entail the destruction of my body, right? Whereby it is transferred from being a body to a corpse. So when we talk about final causes, we're talking about those things which represent the objective term for a nature's flourishing. So because of what I am inclined towards the realization of certain ultimate goods which perfect me as a human person. And the good is always part of this conversation. The good for the human person represents a final cause. And so, like, when St. Thomas talks about the natural law, the famous text is in the Prima Secunda, question 94. He talks about it in terms not only of, like, propositional knowledge, do good and avoid evil. You know, from that we can deduce the Ten Commandments. But he also talks about it as inclinations. So he says, by virtue of the fact that you are a substance, you are inclined to the preservation of your existence. By virtue of the fact that you are an animal, you are inclined to the procreation and education of children. It says, by virtue of the fact that you are a rational animal, you are inclined to know the truth about God, to seek to live well in society, to shun ignorance, to avoid offending those with whom you live, he says, etc. Et alia huius modi. So this is what we mean by the good. Now, the more contentious thing is to describe what we mean by common. So the common good is truly common. For signposting purposes, we're talking about the common good now, so as to recover a vision of real sharing, which is non-competitive and need not be ironized, and then we're going to apply it in friendship. Okay, so we're talking now about what makes the common good common. I'm taking my inspiration in this section from an article by Father Aquinas Gilbo. His last name is spelled G-U-I-L-B-E-A-U. And it's called What is Politics About Anyway? And it's available at academia.edu. It's very readable and I think super clarifying. So what I do here will only be an abbreviation, but I recommend for your reading that article. So first, we have to distinguish common goods from particular goods. Particular goods are those types of goods which diffuse their goodness to just one person. Particular goods are those goods which diffuse their goodness to just one person. So my shoes can only be worn by me. I suppose they could be worn by others, but that would be a bit silly, I suppose. They're my size. They're broken in to my feet. They smell like me, as a result of which they appeal to no one else. So just my shoes, my shirt, my train ticket. There are certain things that in being yours, they are solely yours. They diffuse your goodness only to you, and as a result of which they are necessarily alien to other persons. I think we have a sense of how this works. Now, common goods. Common goods are goods that diffuse their goodness to many persons. They represent the good of many persons at once, simultaneously. By being the proper good of being one person, it's not prohibited from being the proper good of another person. So the good can even be amplified by common participation. So think about it in terms of the family. Is the good of the family somehow diminished by the addition of children? No. Think of the radiant face of a mother when holding her firstborn. It is enriched beyond measure. She doesn't look at the child and say, "How dare you steal my time and attention from my loving husband? Very selfish of you to have been conceived." No, that mother would be crazy. So too, the polity is enriched by its citizenry. When you have persons in your intermediate institution or in your city-state, if New Haven were to be constructed on such a model, you would be delighted when further experts or especially industrious artisans or skilled military leaders would come into your town because they could enrich the common good. So too, think about the church. The church is enriched by her saints, over 10,000 canonized saints. And it's not as if when another saint is canonized, all the ones in heaven are like, "Oh my gosh, bless of God to go around, rats," you know, if they were to speak in such terms. Right, so when, you know, please God, St. Pier Giorgio Frassati, preview of coming attractions, is canonized, St. Therese is going to be laid up in her heavens thinking like, "You exhaust me." No, she'll be very delighted. All right, so they diffuse their goodness to many persons, and they are the good of many persons at once. Now, the next thing to describe is that they are an indivisible whole and not a divisible sum. Again, they are an indivisible whole and not a divisible sum, which is to say that they are one thing, not just a heap of junk. So the examples that Father Aquinas gives in his article are of a reservoir, a candy jar, and a pension fund. These are anti-examples, by the way. He says, a reservoir is only a common good in a certain sense, but not in the truly transcendent sense. Why? Because when you partake of it, when you have water from it, it's diminished. When you use that water, it was formerly common, but then it's arrogated to your use and can never be shared by another. So too, the candy jar. You know, you have the candy jar at the doctor's office. Somewhat strangely, always at the dentist, there are dum-dums. You're like, this is counterproductive. Right? So when you reach your hand in, that's, you know, something that's available for common use, but when you pull your hand out with a dum-dum, that will just be yours. Unto ages of ages. But in a pension fund, you would pay in to a large pot of money. This is a prudential advice. Never leave a pot of money in someone else's care. You'd pay into a pension fund, and at the end of your time of having paid in for X number of years, then you would take out for your years of retirement. But when you do take out, it ceases to be common. It ceases to pertain to the many. It becomes yours. Only you can spend that money, and only you can enjoy the goods purchased by that money. So this is what we mean by a divisible sum. By contrast, a common good in the true sense is an indivisible whole. So it is not diminished by participation. Rather, it possesses a unity, a oneness, a wholeness that diffuses itself universally. And this, Aristotle and St. Thomas describe as a whole of order. Okay? A whole of order. Here we can distinguish it from other kinds of wholes. So on the one hand, you might have a quantitative whole. Right, so like a carton of ice cream. It's a whole thing, in as much as, you know, Ben and Jerry's has very deliciously packaged it for you in a nice fistful size pint, so that way you can eat all of it while only using one hand and your teeth. Right? But it's only a whole in a limited sense, in as much as these things are collected in one place, they have the same identity, but when you, you know, take your first big bite of the tonight dough, then it's not as if the thing changes its constitution. It's all still, you know, tonight dough ice cream. Just some of it is now in your mouth, and then the rest remains in the carton. So it's a quantitative whole. Also, that you have what we would call substantial wholes. And here you can think of, like, organic wholes, so like a plant or a tree or a human person. Their parts don't retain their identity when they are pulled away, as it were. So when you die and the body separates from the soul, you don't have a human person remaining. You have a corpse and a separated soul. So the kind of work that's being done there in integrity or in unity is one of making the one thing to be, but if you lack that unity, then you really don't have the thing at all. So these are two kind of, one side of the spectrum is this strong unity, right, of a substantial whole. On the other end of the spectrum is the kind of weak unity of a quantitative whole. In between, we have what we would call a whole of order. Whole of order is a kind of accidental unity, and effectively what it is a relation of relations. So the persons in the family, or the persons in the polity, or the persons in the church are related to each other, and the relation of the relations constitutes a kind of moral personality, right? So there's something there, and you can think about it in terms of like a family, for instance. When you have a family, there's a real, tangible, palpable sense of a common good that arises in light of the intrinsic ordering of the persons. But say the parents are divorced, it's not as if the mother walks away with half of that and the father walks away with half of that. It's that they walk away with none of it. So if the relations no longer obtain in the way that they once did, then it is lost. But what you have, effectively, is a relation of relations. So this is what we mean when we describe a transcendent common good that is truly good, truly common, not diminished by participation of its members, but rather increased thereby. Now, for our final point, heaven and friendship. What we're talking about is the fact that happiness cannot be had alone. And in order to kind of bring that home in a way that is especially urgent or especially, I don't know, clear, we can talk about the final or ultimate horizon of happiness, and namely the life of heaven, as it's revealed in Christian revelation. So what we hope for on this vision is a loving vision of God, which represents the perfect fulfillment of your powers, to know perfectly, to love perfectly, to fire on all cylinders, to be wholly and entirely the very thing which you were made to be, and to do so without fear of loss or diminishment, without any boredom, but to be given to it and to be received by it, to possess and be possessed in what St. Augustine calls an eternal sunrise, whereby we sing day and night, amen, alleluia. An image that's used to describe heaven in the scriptures is of marriage, okay? Marriage. We are told that in heaven you will neither be married nor given in marriage, the reason for which is because in heaven you will be wed directly to God. You will be wed directly to God. Each and every human heart will be wed directly and immediately to the God by whom she knows herself to be loved. So, in heaven, what we await is the end of the imperfection of the virtues and of the mediation of the sacraments. Basically, everything that we have here, which is only provisional, will be abolished by the overabounding life of God. We will swim in what St. John Damascene calls an infinite ocean of substance. So when you think about faith. Faith is not vision, right? It's knowledge at a distance. It's knowledge by testimony. It's the evidence of things unseen, right? But faith will give way before vision, and so there is no place for faith in heaven. So too, you can think of hope. Hope is the confidence that God will give eternal life because he is omnipotent and merciful. It's a kind of trust. But in heaven, there will be no need for trust because the very thing for which we hope will be possessed. Charity will abide. That's a different story. But think also of the sacraments. The sacraments are signs of sacred things making men holy, says St. Augustine. So they're signs, and by signifying, they mediate a grace. But you do not need signs to point to realities when you are consumed by, given wholly unto the realities. So in heaven, there will be no need for sacraments, one of which is marriage. And think about it. Marriage signifies the love of Christ for his church, says Ephesians 5. Be subordinate to each other out of love for Christ. It begins, I think, in 5:21. But there will be no need for marriage to signify the love of Christ for his church because each person will be loved wholly and entirely by Christ in a way that leaves nothing to be desired. That's not to say that one will be alienated, you know, from her husband in heaven. One will still have a special relationship, but what is signified in that relationship will now be entered into as a reality. So in heaven, we hope for a relationship. We hope for a happiness that is intimate and exclusive, one that is broken open unto life, one that is communal in its setting, one that is shared and in no wise diminished, in no wise competitive, in no wise to be sloughed off. Now here's the thing. The present moment is, St. Thomas says, in coatio beatitudinis, the beginning of beatitude. In the Christian faith, we do not speak of the present as somehow discontinuous with what we hope for. Rather, they are to be understood as a progressive, like, acclimatization. Heaven is a place of rarefied air, and on earth we are meant to acquire the lungs with which to breathe therein. That's to speak somewhat improperly and analogically. But we do not profess some kind of strange delayed gratification, like deny yourself all kinds of things here and then indulge in them in wild ways in heaven. That would be kind of bizarro. Rather, we're talking about a progressive realization of the beatitude that lies in store. So when one looks back on his life from heaven, he should recognize it as having been heaven on earth in a certain sense. So too, C.S. Lewis adds, if one looks back on his life from hell, he will have recognized it as hell on earth. So what we need is to grow in the disposition that recognizes and delights in the common good of beatitude by fidelity to the common goods that are ready at hand. And I think the one that brings this home in most excellent fashion is friendship. So this is our final thought, a kind of epilogue. Friendship is a common good and an entry into common goods. Aristotle talks about friendship as mutual benevolence with a shared life. It must be the willing of the good of the other, the receipt of the same, that is to say, it must be mutual, and there must be a common life. Friends, he says, can live at a distance, perhaps for a time, but it's very difficult to grow a friendship at a distance. It can only really subsist on fumes. Rather, friends must be together. What is willed in a friendship is the other's good. What is willed is the other's good, but a good that is somehow not alienated from your own. Right? We have this modern dichotomy between egoism and altruism. We think that that love is good which is self-denying and other-affirming. But this has never been properly part of the Christian tradition. At least, well, not in St. Thomas's terms. St. Thomas talks about love of concupiscence and love of friendship, but he says that there are two dynamics within the self-same act of love. By love of concupiscence, we regard the good. I love waffle cones, okay? By love of friendship, I regard the person to whom, in this case, me, right? So I love the good unto the person in whom the love terminates. But when I love a friend, I love that good unto him. I regard the good by love of concupiscence. I regard the other person by love of friendship. So I can consider both the good and the other in one sweep. And also I myself am included in that vision as the term from which. So rather than thinking like I need to be wholly self-abnegating and I need to affirm my friend in such a way that I feel terrible so that she can feel great, rather what we want to say is that I can will for another a common life that entails my participation, and that can be for both of us a good. That I can be a good unto another, that I can will myself unto another, with the recognition, yeah, that I have tons of faults, and we need not be scandalized by that fact, but with the recognition that apart from friends, who could live, and that we are thrown in together, we share a common lot, and that the thing willed is a common life, which makes of this present evil age something bearable, something even good, perhaps. So, what I see, then, in this vision is another as bound up with my own good. And this is what Aristotle means by identifying the friend as another self, not as an egotistical extension of my own personality, but rather as someone so intimately bound up with me by virtue of his or her common nature that I bleed into her and she bleeds into me. So I do not think so much about counting whether I have called first or she has called first or how long it's been since the last time she initiated some kind of shindig and blah, blah, blah. Instead, I think about the fact that my good is so deeply and intimately bound up with his or hers that apart from that person, I could not make sense of my life. To deny that friendship would, in a certain sense, to be regressing in my humanity. This, I think, is what we mean by saying that friends make life possible. One of my favorite authors is G.K. Chesterton. He writes a lot of things. Some of them are comprehensible. Others are less so. One of the least comprehensible is The Man Who Was Thursday, which is perhaps his most famous novel. I've read it a couple times, and I still have no idea what it's about. But there are parts of it that I like a lot, so I'll now recount one of them for you. It tells the story of a man named Gabriel Syme, who's a police investigator, and he infiltrates the High Anarchical Council of Europe, on which council sit seven men. And he thinks that they're all anarchists, you know, because he's joined this in bad faith. He's assuming that they joined it in good faith. But at a certain point, he realizes that one of them is also a policeman, and this for him is the source of great joy. And Chesterton writes something like this. He says, throughout the whole ordeal, his root fear had been isolation. I concede to the mathematicians that 4 is twice 2, but 2 is not twice 1. 2 is 2,000 times 1. Here, perhaps, Chesterton is being purposefully paradoxical, but you can appreciate the point. That the difference between not having a friend and having a friend is not like the difference between being like kind of productive and then twice as productive. It's like the difference between being alone and having the prospect of a real happiness. And so as we gaze upon our friendships, we do so with that disposition. We have friends given to us as the appointed means for our entry into heaven. What we await in the end is a friendship, is a Trinitarian communion. From all eternity, the Father begets the Son, and the Father and the Son breathe forth the Holy Spirit, and in that they enjoy a common life. This is offered to us in friendship with Christ. Christ extends, by taking to himself a human nature, the prospect of our being incorporated into that divine life through him. And he has given us all that we need as means whereby to ascend. Aristotle comments that one of the activities that's constitutive of friends is that they share secrets. And we can appreciate why, because when you share a secret with somebody who is not your friend, you fear that it will come back to haunt you, or that you will be betrayed by the knowledge thereof. But with your friend, you do not fear that, because in a certain sense, the secret has not left yourself. Your secret has remained with you. And that person is a part of you, and you a part of them. You are possessed by them, and they possess you. The Lord Jesus says in John 15:15, "I no longer call you slaves, but friends, for I have shared with you everything I have from my Father." The Lord makes us to be his friends by constituting a common life in beatitude by virtue of the grace that he affords and by sharing with us the secrets of the triune life. So, in conclusion, our crisis in living the good life is a more fundamental crisis in commonality. The obstacles seem insurmountable when life places myriad demands, but if our ambitions have us at a distance from the beloved, then they must be subjected to revision. To return to Chris McCandless, though it is perhaps inappropriate to make of him a martyr, at least we can be grateful to him for having communicated in his death that happiness is only real when shared. Thankfully, this is a revelation for which we need not die, for Christ himself has died that we need never live apart. Thank you. If you have questions, I'm delighted to entertain them. Yes?
You talked about marriage in heaven as not being sort of necessary, but we might still have a relationship in a particular way with our spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something similar that the Christian tradition says about friendship?
So I will propose a thought that I think, yes, touches on both themes. So I think it's significant that when Christ appears after the resurrection, he appears with his wounds. Which is to say that there's a narrative dimension to salvation. It's not as if, like, you kind of work your way through a human life and that everything after your death will be eternal and timeless. We do have a kind of participated share in the eternity, the immutability, the timelessness of God, but we will still be marked by what we did and suffered on earth. St. Thomas teaches that all the deeds and sufferings of Christ save, and that Christ kind of deploys them in the sacramental economy as a way by which to apply his merits through time and space. But the application of his merits in time and space, it makes a mark in our humanity, right? So it's not insignificant that the martyrs are often pictured with the engines of their torture, because these have paradoxically or ironically become for them a boast, that this thing revealed the love of God at work in them, or that this shows how very powerful is his grace. So too, I think that our relationships have a way of marking our humanity. So the person, you know, to whom you are married is obviously very significant for your sanctification. I mean, like, spouses joke about this in a kind of hilarious way, like the old cross over there, like the old ball and chain, right? And that's to be like a little bit disrespectful. But at the very least, you can look at your spouse and say, you are the appointed means whereby God is loving me unto heaven. And that makes a difference. Right, that impresses its form upon your humanity. And so I think that, yeah, there will be testimony of the fact that you were beloved of this person was beloved of you in heaven. That will be evident in a way that, like, Christ's wounds are evident. And I think this also holds with friendship. That's not to say that, like, marriage is just a peculiar species of friendship or something like that. Obviously, it's distinct because it has this sacramental dimension. But I think, too, that our friends are appointed means whereby God loves us unto heaven. This is a big thing, because it's not as if God were loving us unto heaven by these means, and then friends are like a side hustle, You know, like, life's tough, so you need friends as, like, a distraction, because if you were just to pay attention to God all the time, it would be oppressive. No. Like, God is loving us. God is giving us grace precisely through our friends. So I think that, yes, we will retain some mark of those by whom we have been loved and those to whom we have entrusted our hearts. So, yeah. Yes.
I want to ask about the costliness of love. I'm thinking about the kind of... there's one way of talking about the costliness of love that uses terms of emotional labor.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, sometimes that vocabulary can miss the mark, or maybe like impute to friendship a kind of that limited view of love, in which if I give my emotional labor to this person, then there's less
mm-hmm.
emotional equilibrium for me. And like, yes, we should set boundaries, but
yeah,
you know, it seems that there's maybe something missing there. And at the same time, there is like a costliness or a sacrificial quality to loving other people well. So how would you invite us to think about that dynamic?
Sure. I'm going to give a concrete instance and then maybe universalize based on that concrete instance. So I typically end conversations. I think often of time and of its constraints. I think often of the fact that I feel at times as if I were dragging my corpse from place to place, you know, like very like underslept and kind of tall, haggard, and hungry. And so as a result of which, I will manage relationships in such a way that I'm often the one like placing the boundaries. But when you do that consistently in a relationship, you communicate to the other person that I am waiting for this conversation to end so that I can do the next thing. And after that happens a few times, the person begins to look at you and just wait for that pronouncement. And that can be kind of objectifying, or at the very least, it just can be sad for that individual. So like, what does it mean to suffer the cost of friendship? Well, that was brought to my attention by a friend, okay? And when that happens, I make the recognition that, okay, on the one hand, it's good that she sees the like demands that this relationship places on just like my energy and humanity. But it's also good that I see like the good in what she's proposing. Right, this is not only like a valid claim, he says in condescending and haughty fashion. Right, this is like the very substance of human life. Right, there is a hierarchy of goods on offer. Sleep ranks among those goods. Friendship also ranks among those goods. And prudentially, we have to arrange that hierarchy depending upon the peculiar circumstances at stake, and that entails a kind of virtuosity of a well-formed human being. But it means being willing to lay down your life for your friend without thinking about it as a grand gesture, but coming to discover that it is delightful to do so because it opens up vistas of friendship that otherwise would not have been, you know, available. Because if I consistently terminate conversations, I will always be kind of slavishly governed by a mindset of hyper-utility or hyper-efficiency. But by being receptive to and docile to this, like, correction or prompting, like, new worlds open before my eyes. So I think that... on a certain sense, like, it's helpful to evaluate it in the paradigm of justice. It's also helpful to evaluate it in a paradigm of charity. And the two, in perfect friendship, kind of bleed together. And when we find ourselves really put out, we tend to lean on justice. And we find ourselves carried away, we tend to lean on charity. But I think it just, there are a lot of moving parts. But it's possible to navigate a way through it. And specifically, if you have friends who are good about communicating those things to you, they're like a mirror of eternity. They reveal before you things that you did not know were even possible of being known. Yeah, and then you can say in genuineness, like, I actually trust you more than I trust myself in this. And as a result of which, I can give myself to you more than I formerly thought possible, precisely because I know that you have my good in mind. So I think that's the beginning of an answer.
That's great.
Yes?
When you're commenting on the man who was Thursday, you talked about, or Jason talked about, it's almost like getting your heart is going from zero to infinity, or like gaining another self.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So how does one make friends?
How does one make friends? So how does one make friends? C.S. Lewis has this really trenchant critique in The Four Loves where he says, in order to have friends, you must want something more than friends. Which is fascinating because I've had the experience where you wanted so desperately to be friends with somebody, but then you came to discover that that was not a sufficient grounds for actually... having a friendship, right? Because what the necessary precondition is not, I want to be friends with you. The necessary precondition is discovering a common interest that kind of carries you along. And there have been some criticisms made of C.S. Lewis's vision of friendship in that book, because he talks about friends as side-by-side, he talks about lovers as face-to-face. And I think that that might be like a kind of stiff upper lip British characterization of friendship between men, because I think there is a face-to-face dimension in friendship, you know, between men or between women or between a man and a woman. But what is important is that the common good assert a kind of preeminence in the relationship. So it's and people have had this experience. Like sometimes you're in a relationship where you feel like you're constantly trying to take the temperature of the other person, like you're constantly engaged in mind reading, and you find it very tumultuous because you're making adjustments always on the basis of, you know, hints or fine shades or very subtle indications, and that can be exhausting. Whereas if you are both focused on some common good, then a lot of those details kind of get worked out. An image that I've seen somewhere, I've forgotten where, but like the author says, picture a flotilla of ships that have no navigational instruments, right? They can't navigate by the stars either. And so they have two options. They can navigate with respect to each other, or they can navigate with respect to some point on the horizon. If they navigate with respect to each other, there will be no end to the madness. But if they all pick a common point on the horizon, they will proceed apace together, and they might make adjustments, right? But they can guarantee that this common trajectory will do most of the work of spacing them out. So I think that making friends is like that. And oftentimes it's very maddening because there are very few intermediate institutions in which to find these people, right, because of the kind of crisis in community in the United States. But there are many options in college, and some of them can seem hokey, you know, like student life generated opportunities to meet other people, and you're like, wow, I would rather die. So then it's a matter of you making organic ones. That may mean you being somewhat silly. Like, I'm passionately interested in stamp collecting, and so I'm going to put a flyer up about the Philately Club. And maybe there's, like, no one that comes to the first meeting, but maybe there's somebody who comes to the second meeting, and that person might be a lifelong friend. I take that as a kind of silly example, but, I mean, you can feel persecuted even to do things that are less silly than the Philately Club, but it means actually putting yourself out there. And yes, you may be disappointed. Yes, you may be deeply saddened, but you have to make your loves known in order to discover fellow travelers. So thank you so much.